I'm speaking with James Akagi, who retired in 1995 as professor of microbiology at the University of Kansas. We're in Lawrence, Kansas on September 25th, 1995. Where were you born and in what year?
I was born in Seattle, Washington, 1927, December 23rd, 1927.
What were your parents' names?
My parents' names? My father's name is Teiji Akagi, and my mother's name is Yone Akagi.
Could you spell those so when I write it out, I'll know what...
All right, Teiji is T-E-I-J-I, mm-hmm. And my mother's name is Yone, Y-O-N-E. And they...
Okay. What was their educational background?
Well, my father was the second son and in Japan, the first son gets everything.
Oh.
And the second, third, and of course, any females get nothing. It's only the first son that gets everything.
Uh-huh.
And from... In my family, or my father's family, which is a samurai family, the first son got everything, the samurai sword, the home and everything. So the second sons of most of the people would emigrate. My father was one of them that came to this country about 1920, somewhere around there. And then my mother came later as his bride. And settled in Seattle, Washington, and there it had, I have three older sisters, and then I came, and then I have a younger brother, the five of us.
What was your father's occupation?
He was a produce, he ran a produce house, that is to say, he would get all the produce from the farmers around Seattle and pack them up and ship them off to the various cities.
Mm-hmm.
And he also operated a grocery store.
Oh, uh-huh. Did you grow up in Seattle then?
Yes, I grew up in Seattle until I was 14 years old, just starting high school, and that's when World War II broke out.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 1942, we all had to go into these camps, so-called concentration camps of the United States.
Yeah, I've heard of that. Where did your family go?
To Minidoka, Idaho. It's just right by Twin Falls.
Oh,
and,
really?
There was a camp. There were 10 of these camps scattered throughout the United States in the interior,
uh-huh.
away from the West Coast, and approximately 10,000 in each camp. There were a total of 120,000 Japanese on the West Coast.
Oh, my.
And we were all evacuated into these camps.
That would be like a small town then.
Well, it wasn't like a town. You see, it was a... It was barracks with barbed wire fences, with guard towers and guards and everything. It was a concentration camp. That's what it was.
That
Roosevelt and Truman admitted
uh-huh.
these were not just camps. These were what they would consider a concentration camp with limited movement by people involved. And so we were in this camp for up until 1945, 3 years.
So you went to elementary school then back in Seattle?
Elementary school in Seattle through the 8th grade, and then I just started the 9th grade when we were evacuated. So from the 9th, 10th, 11th, and 12th, I went in to school in camp.
Well, they had school then there.
Yes,
so you graduated from high school then while you were in camp.
I was the last graduation class in 1945 is when I graduated.
And did your father then lose his business when he...
Well, yes, everyone that was evacuated. Everyone had very short notice to evacuate. And so there were some that had only 24 hours.
Oh my goodness.
Some people had 2 weeks,
uh-huh.
and to get rid of everything within that period of time was virtually impossible, and so a lot of people were coming around buying material very cheaply, and people had to get rid of their properties, whatever they can get, There were some people who were fortunate to have some very good Caucasian friends who said they would take care of their property for them, which mm-hmm. they did
mm-hmm.
Until the war ended. And so, but most of the people were just, well, they were left with nothing. And because of that, President Reagan signed in 1988 this entitlement
mm-hmm.
to pay every person $20,000, which didn't cover it all, but at least it's some way of saying they apologize.
Yeah. Did your family go back to Seattle then when you were released?
No. There was nothing for us to go back to because we had nothing there in 45. So our family relocated to Chicago, Illinois, and made a new start.
You had relatives there or
no,
something?
No, nothing. No, we just...
You just... Your father just chose Chicago?
Well, it was not my father or my mother. By then, it was the children now that took over.
I see.
Because they were called Iseis, meaning the first generation in this country. We are the Nisei, the second generation.
Mm-hmm.
The second generation people are the American citizens because we were born here.
Yeah.
First generation were not.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because of the law that was passed, they could not become naturalized or anything. They were not citizens.
Oh,
all right?
I see.
The law was passed in, I think, 1924 or something, saying no person from any part of Asia could become an American citizen or become naturalized. So my parents, like any other people's parents, could not even own property. So the property that they had, many people used to take it out in the name of their oldest child.
I see.
In our case, it was my sister, oldest sister. So, and not only that, they can speak English very well and everything, and our generation was slowly getting older. The average age at that time, 1942, was about 17 for all of us. So we were not old enough to take charge of everything.
Yeah.
And so that's why we were involved in the evacuation, and some people fought it, saying they will not go, and they were put into jail for the duration of the war. But because we were so young, we had to just go along with whatever they said.
Mm-hmm.
And then in camp, it was the children, the older children, that decided what the family would do. And so my sisters decided, well, we'll go to Chicago. And by then, most of the parents just followed whatever their children told them to do, wherever their children told them to go.
Uh-huh.
So we came to Chicago. And then I started college there in 45.
What school did you go to?
I went to a junior college in Chicago. At that time, it was a junior college. Now it's a four-year college called North Park Junior College at that time. And I went to, just took a general course. At first year, you have no choice but take certain requirements. And I went there and played baseball for the team, college and everything.
Had you played baseball before?
Well, we played
like
a lot
camp
in camp. We, yes.
I suppose to have something to do.
We played a lot of football, a lot of ping pong, a lot of pinochle. We had a lot of time in camp because there was nothing to do. And so in camp, we had a lot of spare time and we learned to do everything. So most of us, the younger group, like my age group, 14 to 17, we played a lot of sports.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, in Chicago, my first year, I went to college and played baseball. And after the end of that year, I was up for the draft. I was 18 years old, so getting ready to be drafted by the Army because the draft was still on.
Uh-huh.
And so I went into the Army in 1946.
Oh.
So.
And where did you go to your training then?
Well,
in the Army,
of course, you go through basic training in Fort McClellan, Alabama.
Uh-huh.
And then from there, the Army sort of got mixed up on my records. My outfit went to Korea. But I was left behind it was a mix-up in my thing. A very kind colonel called me and said, I mean, he knew that I came from the West Coast. He fought with a lot of Japanese Americans in Europe. He said he'd like to do something for me. So he said, would you like to go to the West Coast? And I said, sure, I'd love to go back up to close to Seattle. And so he said, all right, then you won't go with your company to Korea. I'll make orders for you to go to the West Coast. And so I stayed behind. But then the Army mixed somehow, like they always do, get it all mixed up, and I didn't go to the West Coast. I went to Fort Dix, New Jersey instead, the opposite direction. And they didn't know what I was there for. So after three or four months of just doing nothing, they said, well, they'll send me to school in the Army.
Oh, uh-huh.
And they sent me down to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, where they sent me to laboratory school, where I came across microbiology, as hematology, all the things that you do in a medical lab. And so
they were training you to be a medic then, or something?
A medical lab technician.
Oh, I see.
The one that works in the laboratory.
Yes,
you know?
Uh-huh.
And so that's the school that I went to, and that's where I was first introduced to microbiology, that I found fascinating.
Yeah.
But the Army, just before I finished, I was ordered to go to Washington, D.C., to go into the Pentagon. Why me, I don't know, but anyway, they said I had to teach the people there how to do what they call venipuncture, take blood from the people.
Oh, mm-hmm.
Because that's what we learned at the school in San Antonio. And so I worked, I was stationed in Fort Myers, which is just outside of Washington, and they sent me to the Pentagon every day with a staff car, and I got a ride every morning, and I went down and worked in the Pentagon, drawing blood from the people, the dependents who were going overseas to join their husbands, and all this time,
yeah.
And they all had to have their blood tests, and
uh-huh.
And they had no one qualified to do that, so that's why they got me, and so I was the one taking all the blood from people going over to Europe, and trying to teach the people, technicians there,
mm-hmm.
how to do it. And when finally they were in a position where they can do the blood taking without me, then I was just stationed in Fort Myers. I didn't have to go to the Pentagon anymore after about 3 months. And then I was stationed in the Fort Myers Medical Laboratories, where I stayed until my discharge in 1948. And in 1948, I was discharged from the Army. I came back home to Chicago and enrolled at the University of Illinois.
Had you always expected that you would go to college then?
Oh yes, from the time I was very young, my parents said, we're all going to go to college. Or at least I was going to go to college. My sisters did not. Well, one of my sisters did. My middle sister, she was very talented. She is very talented. She was a violinist.
Oh.
And during the war, while we were in camp, she went out of camp and went to Oberlin and to the music conservatory there and got her degree in music. And she went on to playing at the, starting with the Kansas City Symphony, the St. Louis Symphony, and got accepted by the Chicago Symphony until they found out she was a girl. It's all men. It's
oh,
the Chicago
really?
Symphony.
I didn't
we used to be. And because of her name that she used, Terry, they thought she was a he until she went up for her interview. And then they couldn't accept her on the symphony because at that time, I don't know how it is now, but at that time it was all male. Symphony. So anyway, she eventually married another person from St. Louis in the St. Louis Symphony, and they went to Hollywood where they were playing in the movies and the TV and there are just and the symphonies there, the Los Angeles symphonies.
Uh-huh.
So they were professional musicians.
I see.
And they're now retired.
Mm-hmm. So you went back and you went to the University of Illinois.
Yes.
And you were majoring then in microbiology?
That's right. And I got my bachelor's degree there. And while I was there, I met another graduate student at that time in the department who came from Kansas. Later on became a very well-known microbiologist, biochemist. But anyway, he was telling me about possible places to go, because in those years, the general policy of people graduating from any university was not to go on in graduate school at that same university.
Oh, yeah.
They try to send you away.
Uh-huh.
And so I was looking for a place to go, and he said Kansas was a pretty good place. And so I applied and got accepted at Kansas. I was still on the GI Bill at that time. See, the GI Bill, because I was in the Army for 2 years,
yeah.
I had a total of 36 months. It's 20, the total amount of time plus 12 months they give you.
I see.
So I had 36 months of schooling. And so I had 1 year in to begin with, so I had 3 years left, and that was 27 months. I had one more year, and so I used that to come to Kansas in graduate school. And I came here and took courses here and on the GI Bill, and I didn't have any financial aid at that time, so I, after 1 year, I said, well, since I have no financial aid, I'll just go back to Chicago and work. And I worked in a consultant laboratory for breweries, testing beer and all these things, analyzing beer, because a lot of breweries have problems, microbiological problems.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked there until Dave Peretsky at this department here at Kansas got some money, and he got word to me that he had a research assistantship for me if I would come back to college. And so the next year I came back and pursued a master's degree and then eventually a PhD.
Was he your major professor?
He was my professor, yes. Mm-hmm. He was my mentor.
Did you write a thesis for your master's?
Yes, I wrote a thesis for my master's.
What were you studying for your master's?
Well, my major interest in graduate school in microbiology was biochemistry.
Mm-hmm.
I loved chemistry. And so I applied chemistry to microbiology, which is essentially biochemistry.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a biochemical problem for my master's degree, something about how proteins are put together, and similar sort of thing for my PhD. I just followed it up and did a chemical problem for my PhD. So, and I graduated in 1959. Where I had my PhD here.
Uh-huh. Do you remember any other influential teachers from that time besides Mr. Peretsky?
Oh, yes. One person that was very influential was Dr. Ray Brewster, who was a chairman of chemistry. He was the one that really excited me in organic chemistry, and he was a very stimulating teacher. He was very, very good, and Dr. Brewster, Dr. McEwen at that time, was another organic chemistry teacher, and they just got me interested, and very much interested in chemistry, and I just, instead of becoming a chemistry major, I applied that chemistry to microbiology, and because of that, all my students went the same route as I did. They all had to learn their chemistry, so that was the basis of my so-called program in microbiology for graduate students.
And what building was this in at that time?
Well, we were in Snow Hall, Old Snow Hall, that we call it,
mm-hmm.
And we were doing all the microbiology work and teaching microbiology and everything. All the biological sciences were in the hall, other than a couple of the departments, such as biochemistry and Old Hayward. But we were in Snow Hall until 1969, when they built the new, so-called new Hayworth or Haworth Hall,
mm-hmm.
And we moved into that department in 1969.
Did you then teach for the first time while you were a graduate student?
Yes, after my degree was in 1959, but I actually finished the work in 1958. Just right after the deadline. Dr. Paretsky said he will keep me on as an instructor, where I can teach that whole academic year until 1959, because that's when my degree was actually conferred. So I stayed on until 1959, and during that year I was looking around for a postdoctoral position. I found one, which was Western Reserve University Medical School. So my postdoctoral years, right after 1959, was spent in Cleveland, Ohio, at Western Reserve, now known as Case Western Reserve.
Oh, uh-huh.
And so I spent 2 years there furthering my chemistry, microbiology background, and I got introduced to a whole new group of microorganisms by a person called Leon Campbell, very well-known individual. He later became the president of the American Society for Microbiology, which is a very great honor. But he was a young person that had lots of ideas, and then I talked to him before I took a postdoctoral with him, and he said coming over to Western Reserve would be very nice, that we can do some work together. And I almost had committed myself to Johns Hopkins at that time, but at the last second I changed my mind and went to Western Reserve.
Were you married at this time?
No, I got married 1 year into my postdoc. That is to say, my first year in Cleveland I was not married, but my fiancée was here. She was a graduate student in the department of microbiology.
Oh, really?
And so I came back after the first year, then we got married in 1960. August 3rd, 1960.
And what was her name?
Barbara Jean West was her name. And we went back to Cleveland to finish my postdoctoral at that time. After my postdoctoral training, which ended in 1961, I was looking for a job, because most postdoctoral training, like internships, are generally 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, one goes to a job. And I was looking around, I was considering, I got an offer from Northwestern, but this is Chicago. And I was, as I told you, I lived in Chicago for a while and thought that this is not a place to raise a family.
Yeah.
And so having known Lawrence for a while, and not only that, but my wife's family were right in Missouri. And so she was very excited about coming back here if we could. And so Dave Paretsky at that time was the chairman, and he offered me a position here. So that's how I ended up back in Kansas in 1961. And
what were you teaching at KU then?
Well, I taught mainly courses in my field, which was, we called it microbial physiology or microbial biochemistry. But all of us, had to teach introductory microbiology. So I taught introductory microbiology, I taught microbial biochemistry, I introduced another course later on called applied microbiology, because by then people were becoming interested in the applications of microbiology, so I thought, well, I could use some of my prior experience in working at the consultant laboratories for breweries on how microbiologists could utilize their knowledge in analyzing foods, as well as how to make wine, how to make beer or cheese, and all this. So it was a course in in which the lecture part was mostly biochemical, but the laboratory part was actually making these products like yogurt, cheese, wine, sauerkraut, and all these things. And
that must have been an interesting lab.
The kids loved it. They enjoyed it very much. That was an undergraduate course. It was not a graduate course. So,
did you teach then some undergraduate and some graduate courses?
Yes. Taught undergraduate beginning course, introductory courses, which I enjoyed very much. And this applied microbiology and graduate courses until 1967. You see, when I came here, of course, in 1961 as an assistant professor.
Uh-huh.
In 1964, I was an associate. And in 1967, I became a full professor. In 1967, I also received the government had in terms of award, research award, and research career development award.
Oh, uh-huh.
And what that award was, that the government would pay the recipient's total salary, 12-month salary, and the university would agree to hire someone else to take the recipient's place in teaching. So, if they wanted to.
So that you could do just research.
Research, that's right. So I got this degree and I got this award and for 1967 for 5 years.
Oh.
And then I got a renewal for another five. So actually for a total of 10 years I was on this research career development award, in which I did not have to teach at all, just do nothing but research because I qualified and I competed well enough to get it. But I wanted to continue teaching anyway, and so I did teach every once a year at least. Continued working in the classroom as well as in the research laboratories, and I got. It was a very good thing for 10 years where I didn't have to worry about my salary. The university gained because they didn't have to pay out my salary. And since Dr. Persky did not hire anyone to take my place in teaching, the university was able to save that money because I said I would teach, continue teaching. And so I was on this for 10 years. Very interesting.
Yeah. What was your research interest then during this time?
Well, my research after my postdoctoral training, that's where I got my introduction to this field by Leon Campbell. He introduced me to these very interesting organisms, the bacteria, that really had nothing to do with medical microbiology, but of interest in ecology. And it's these organisms that you find at the sulfur springs. Those that give you that smell, that it's called H2S, hydrogen sulfide, and the organism is produced by bacteria, and the bacteria would take sulfate and reduce it to H2S, and so these organisms are called the sulfate reducing bacteria, and these are those organisms that do not grow in the presence of air. They must have what we call anaerobic conditions, and under these conditions they produce this gas, and it was a very fascinating a group of organisms because not too much was known, and so I got involved in this and decided, well, this is what I want to study for the rest of my career, and so I brought this problem back with Dr. Campbell's permission to Kansas, and the other scientists in the building didn't appreciate it because when I worked with this, the smell would permeate through the whole building, you know, and they were calling it Akagi's outhouse, you know. it was Snow Hall the same way, as well as Old Hayworth. I worked with this organism and got a lot of grant money that was available for this, and so I was well supported during my tenure as a faculty member at KU.
Did you have publications then?
Oh, yes. Yeah, you had to publish to keep getting these grants, and the RCDA, the Research Career Development Award, made it possible for me to spend a lot of time in the research laboratory instead of the classroom. The classroom was, I did do it, but it was minimal compared to what I would have done.
Yeah.
And so I was able to spend more time in research, and I had very good students who worked and produced papers, and you had to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and even today you have to.
Sure.
And that, because that we were fortunate and in publishing papers, and we continued to get these grants. And we got grants from the NIH, the Public Health Service, the National Science Foundation, NASA was interested in our problem, and so we got grants from various sources. And I was on the editorial board for the Journal of Bacteriology, which was the main journal of the American Society for Microbiology, the microbiologist thing. And so because of that, I was able to keep up with a lot of publications. Because on the editorial board, you see a lot of papers, so
yeah.
That helped me.
Uh-huh. Did you ever write a book?
No, I didn't write a book. I didn't want to take the time to ever write a book. I contributed to three books.
Oh, uh-huh.
That were, you know, that people are writing, and
yeah.
And they said, would you write a chapter?
Write a chapter.
And I said, sure, I can do that, but I won't write a book. So I was able to write chapters, and the last one coming out this year. So it was very nice that I was able to finish my career with a chapter anyway.
Let's see, I guess I forgot to ask you about your children. They were born here in Lawrence, I suppose?
Yes, I have an older, two boys. One born 1961. He was born in 61, and one second one was born in 1963. The older one is now, well, of course, 34, going on 35. Both are unmarried, unfortunately. I can't talk them into getting married yet. The older one is a government agent. He worked for the Drug Enforcement Administration.
Oh.
He's a, what they call DEA
mm-hmm.
agent, and he's in the Dominican Republic at this time, working on drugs. The younger one is in Tempe, working in real estate. So they're both fine, and I just hear from them from time to time.
Did the, you were in KU then in the late 60s, early 70s, when there were so many problems here.
Oh, yes.
Did that affect you or your department?
No, not really. The only time that we were really involved during that period of unrest was when we had to, everyone in New Hayworth.
Mm-hmm.
Had to watch guard at night. I don't know if people remember that.
A few people have mentioned that.
That we'd have to stroll the hallways at night and stay all night because the bomb went off in right next door to Summerfield.
Yeah.
Right by the computer.
Uh-huh.
And so we were on guard. That's the only time that I was really involved, when we were involved in this unrest, other than a few marches that they had. I never took part in it, but these marches occurred, and some faculty members were involved in these marches, I know, during in the 1960s. But that was a time when I was able to spend an awful lot of time in my research.
I assume you didn't have administrative responsibilities since your major area was research.
None until 1976, in which, when Dr. Paretsky stepped down as chairman, I was appointed as the chairman.
Oh, I see.
I became the chairman against my will, really. I didn't really want it, but at the same time I said every person should try it once.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, all right, I'll try it. And I was chairman from 1976 to 1985 when I just said I can't take it anymore. My wife died in 1982.
Uh-huh.
And I was going to resign then, but at that time KU was undergoing some real severe budget cuts. And
yeah.
I said, well, I can't let that stop me from at this time. So I didn't resign then. I said, I'll see this through and stayed until I finally got back. And then I said, now I can resign. And when I stepped down as chair in 1985. And then in 1989, I was called back to become acting chair again, 1989 to 1991. And I figured the only way I can get out of that was to go on sabbatical. So I went on sabbatical, and since then I've been out of the chair.
Do you remember anything specific that happened that you wanted to mention what was going on in the department while you were chairman?
Well, there were a lot of challenges at that time, but is it almost the end? Or?
Well, I'll turn it over when it is, but I just want to make sure that I see when it stopped.
Oh, not that much.
Sure. Yeah.
But the first 9 years were not bad. Trying to learn how to chair the department. The most difficult part of chairing the department, as I found out, was treating everyone equally fair.
Yeah.
It's very difficult to do.
You mean like merit pay and things like
that?
That's
right. And even though you like some faculty member, and you want to give that faculty member a good raise, if that faculty member did not produce according to the criteria that you put down, then you cannot give that faculty member.
Yeah.
And some faculty member that you don't care for as much would get the bigger raise and everything. And it was the only way to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You had to do it. And that, I think, at least, I know I have lost some close friends because of that, but it's the only way that I can think of doing it. And I think eventually those friends realized that at least I was honest about the whole thing. At least my conscience was clear. But that was, I think, a very difficult thing for any chair to do.
Yeah.
When it comes to that, because some people would come and ask you for a raise, and you cannot. Even though the raises weren't that much,
mm-hmm.
And you'd like to give it to them, it's very difficult, because if you put down the set of criteria that you say you're going to use for raises, you got to stick to it.
And the budget cuts must have been very difficult, too.
The budget cuts were difficult. I tried to let the faculty decide what to do, but then sometimes that didn't work out either. Sometimes they had some bad advice that I should have used my own intuition in solving these cuts, but it was a good learning process. At least I can tell the chairman now when they would come to me, like the present chair would ask me for advice, at least I'm able to give that person some advice of what not to do anyway,
mm-hmm.
mistakes that I made. And so it was a good experience, but something I didn't want it in the first place, but I learned.
Yeah. You were on university committees, I suppose.
Yes, I was on quite a few university committees during my time, like the promotion and tenure, the college committee on faculty appointments, promotion and tenure. I was on that for a while. I was on the biomedical research grant committee, the university general research grant, the CBUD, the committee on the budget for the college, member of various search committee for chairman of various departments, writing across the curriculum committee that I was on until I finally retired, and I still don't know what that committee was all about. Steering committee for establishing the school of religion into the college, I don't know whether I regret that or not, but I was in charge of getting the school of religion into the college at that time. Well, very, very various committees that many people serve on while they're here. At the national level, I went to, been on the University of Hawaii, asked me to teach a course there one time, and which I was able to do that. The members of various panel members, you know, for NSF, the CAUSE programs, for postdoctoral programs, editorial board member, then site visit members for Department of Energy. There's and reviewers for various other publications, and members of panels for the Department of Energy and many of their whatever grants that they would be giving out. So the usual thing that I'm sure most people are involved with.
You mentioned that you went on a sabbatical. Did you have just one, and where did you go, and what did you do?
Oh, the first one was, well, that was in 1981. I went to the University of Hawaii because they invited me to teach there before, and then I made some friends there while I was there. And then they were doing some, the person that was there in the biochemistry department was doing some work that I wanted to do in my laboratory. And matter of fact, he contacted me and we had a collaborative problem going out together with another person down in biochemistry. It was two people, Dr. Hirsch, Dr. Himes, and I. So we all collaborated with that person in Hawaii because he was doing all the work, the very, very one thing that we didn't know how to do. So we sent him all the material that he was doing the work there.
And this was the University of Hawaii?
Yes, Hawaii. And so I decided to take a sabbatical in his laboratory to learn that particular technique. And that was in 1981. And I spent that year, I was there from August on. But that was the year my wife became sick, and she died January of 82, so they called me back, the doctor called me back in December of 81. So my sabbatical was cut short at that time. So I just came back and just went on to teaching back to my chair. And then I had another sabbatical in 91. That's, I took that to get out of the acting chair position. I went to Germany.
That must have been interesting.
Very interesting. I took it in the laboratory of my student who got his PhD with me, went to a very well-known biochemist, and from there established himself as a very good up-and-coming young microbiologist. The German universities saw this, and so they hired him to become a professor at one of the universities. And so he was now the big shot professor there, and I said, well, I'll go over there and do a sabbatical with him.
What university was that?
Bayreuth. This was the University of Bayreuth. B-A-Y-R-E-U-T-H. A lot of people don't know how to pronounce that, but... But I wanted to go back to Germany because I was invited there 10 years earlier, really, in 1980, for an international conference on work on some of the things that I've been doing in my laboratory. And so they invited me, with just all expenses paid, so I had a free vacation there, and where I enjoyed Germany. But my younger brother was in Germany for, he was in Germany for 30 years. He married a German girl, and he was teaching in Munich, American dependents, teaching in an American school.
I see.
And so he He taught there, and so he was there. So that's why every time I went to Germany, I was able to go see him, and he just took me around everywhere, so, and introduced me to things, that I love Germany. And that's the reason why I decided I would like to go back to Germany for a sabbatical in 1991. And it was a good opportunity because my student was a professor there.
You belong to professional organizations, I suppose.
Yes, the three main ones, the American Chemical Society, of course, because I was always enjoyed chemistry, the American Society for Microbiology, and the other one was American Society for Biochemistry and Molecular Biology. So those are the three main ones that I wanted to be a member of. And
did you hold offices in any of these organizations?
No, I did not. The only office was at the regional level. The American Society for Microbiology is made up of regional so-called various regions in the United States, and we all have our own group, you might say, like the Big Eight, for example. And so we would have the Missouri Valley branch of the American Society for Microbiology, and I was president of that in 1972, and as well as being other, we all had to take turns. I did not want to become part of any committees at the national level. They just take too much time away from your research.
Yeah.
And research was my main interest. That's the reason why most people come to universities.
Mm-hmm.
That they could do the research. And being hired for teaching is a way of getting to research.
You mentioned the one former student that became a professor in Germany. Are there any other outstanding former students you'd like to mention?
Yes, there are quite a few students that went through my laboratory. one very bright student that I had was from Korea, and he got his PhD, did some very good work, went from here, and got involved in research, and somehow got involved in with a person who wanted to send him to medical school on his postdoctoral. While on his postdoctoral years, he decided, well, he'll go to medical school. So he went to medical school, and he is now a very good infectious disease person at Temple University.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny, I got another student from Korea who came to my laboratory roughly about 15 years later, and he said that first student, whose name was Bing So, he said that Dr. So is very well known in Korea as an example of what a person can accomplish in America.
Oh.
And so he said that it's very difficult for him to realize that he is in the same laboratory that Dr. So came from. And that one, named Jay Kim, got his degree, and now he's a chairman at one of the Korean universities. I have a student from, another one from Iran, who got his degree and is back in Iran again. He's chairman of one of the universities there, microbiology. Then Harold Drake is the professor there in Germany.
He was an American then who became a professor in Germany.
Oh yes, he was from Kansas. He has a Kansas accent.
Oh,
he speaks,
I thought
German
perhaps
with a
he was a German.
Oh no, he was a, which was, that was the amazing thing about him, because Germans tend to hire Germans.
Uh-huh.
But he was just a plain old Kansan and made a big name, and they hired him, and he had to learn German, which he's very good at now. But he's just a. I was just over there this past summer after I retired. I went out to visit him again, and now so he's doing very well. There were others, Tom Novitzky is CEO of a company in Massachusetts, just outside of Boston, a leading company in the world on a certain analytical method that they discovered, and crabs, how to detect certain bacteria.
Oh.
It's becoming very important now medically, because in people who have various infections, one of the bad things that could happen is what they call septic shock. It's the bacterial product going through your whole body and causing the person, could cause death very easily. And doctors are very concerned about this condition anytime you have a bad infection. Well, this Tom Novitzky's company is isolated a factor from what they call the horseshoe crab out there in the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
And this component can detect very minute amounts of this toxic substance.
Oh, really?
And it's now it's everywhere in the world. I mean, he is sending a postcard from virtually every part of the world. Russia, Japan, France, England, you name it, he's been there because he had to go help set up a laboratory.
Uh-huh.
Or set up a business there. And so he's a big big shot. And he is now the CEO there. My brightest student was a woman, Mei Chan. She came from Taiwan, and she is now working for the Navy in China Lake, California. And she was so good, she has been put up many times as Woman of the Year for that section. Some university unit right outside of Stanford, Pauling Institute or something. Anyway, they offered her essentially an endowed chair. And she called and asked if she should take it. I said, go ahead, take it. But she didn't take it because she was with her husband, and her husband did not get any job over there. And her husband was a big shot at China Lake, so she decided to bypass it. But she was the brightest student I ever had. But the most interesting case about a student was not a student that was not mine, but somehow came to KU. And I used to tell this to my classes whenever we come to this part of the course. The person's name was Satoshi Mizutani. Well, I was going back now to my postdoctoral years. I was in Cleveland,
mm-hmm.
and I was doing postdoctoral work there, doing research. And another postdoctoral was from Japan. His name was Sam Suzuki. And Sam and I were very close friends, as well as a lot of all of us postdocs are very close. Anyway, Sam went to Manitoba. He got a job in Manitoba, Canada, and I came to Kansas. And Satoshi Mizutani was a student from Japan looking for a place to go, and he wanted to be, he would be more comfortable if a person that he went to was Japanese, so he heard of Suzuki. Sam Suzuki. So he wrote to Sam Suzuki and said he'd like to go there, but Sam said, right now the department can't use any students, but I have a friend in Kansas to write to Jamakagi here. And so Satoshi wrote to me, and I was on the admissions committee at that time, and I said, oh, just another one of hundreds that was coming in. So I said, why don't you write to me later on in the year, and I'll know more about it. And I thought that would be the end of it. Well, he didn't forget. He wrote me at the end of the year, and since we had some money, I said, okay, why don't you come over, we can give you a research grant. He came over, he was a very good student. He was working with another person, but the interesting thing is after he got his PhD, he was looking for a postdoctoral position. And one of the person, Dave Peretsky, just came back from Wisconsin from his sabbatical, and he said, there's a person up there named Howard Timmons. Who could use a postdoc. Well, Satoshi was applying to everywhere, and all of a sudden, one of the places that he applied to was Howard Timmons, and Timmons invited him to come work with him. And so Timmons was a very interesting person. He was, for 10 years, or 5 to 10 years, was saying that one of the genetic material in this virus that he was working was RNA. Now, everyone knows DNA is a uh-huh. genetic material, and RNA is just another part of nucleic acid similar to DNA, but different. And everyone says, you're crazy. You know, as a matter of fact, they were laughing at him and saying, you know, who would ever think that RNA could be the genetic material when everyone knows it has been established that DNA is the genetic material. Now Satoshi Mizutani goes to Temin's lab and as his postdoc, and pretty soon Satoshi is writing back to us saying there's some very interesting thing that will be reported at the Houston meetings. Howard Temin will report it. And what Howard Temin reported was he got unequivocal proof that RNA could also be the genetic material in this virus, as Satoshi Mizutani found in his laboratory. And Temin got the Nobel Prize for it.
Oh.
But Satoshi did all the work, because Temin did not know biochemistry. He just had this by circumstantial evidence that RNA was involved, but mm-hmm. when Satoshi went up there, and we trained our graduate students in biochemistry, and so he went up there, he was able to do the biochemistry that finally allowed Temin to get his Nobel Prize. And so we're very proud of that.
Yes.
But there were many good students that went through
yeah.
my laboratory. I was proud of many of them.
Sounds like it.
So.
Were you involved in community activities in Lawrence?
Only when the kids were growing up. One more or less has to, and I was happy to do that. Like, of course, the Boy Scout or whatever you call it, and
Boy Scouts,
and Cub Scouts, and you know all these things, as well as other things. We used to travel to various grade schools to demonstrate to them what microbiology is.
Oh, really?
We would bring our whole microscope and all these other things, and usually to classes where someone knew something who knew my sons, and so you know it would be more or less an invitation, personal invitation from
uh-huh.
that student. And but we used to go around, and matter of fact, used to advertise to teachers, look, if you want us to come by, we'll be happy to teach for 1 hour at least, give a demonstration
yeah.
of what microbiology.
That would be interesting to kids.
Let them look at microscopes and let them see why they should put coins in their mouth and everything. And so we used to do that.
Yeah.
It was a lot of fun. And,
uh-huh.
and I think some of it's still being done by the department.
Oh. Do you have continuing involvement with KU now that you're retired?
Well, with the department, I'm still a member of some of the students' committees. The PhD committee,
mm-hmm.
But other than that, I more or less told them, let me at least for this first year, I just started my retirement 3 months ago,
uh-huh.
let me just enjoy my retirement and not have anything to do with academics. After that first year or two, if I'm still here in Lawrence, then I'll reconsider, you know, in case
mm-hmm.
I want to get back to do something, whatever it may be. But right now, I'm not interested in doing anything. With the university, I'm involved in my thing. Like, I went to Germany, and I went to Seattle, where I was born, and a couple of times, and taking these trips.
So you're interested, that's what I was going to ask you, is what your plans are. What are you going to do now that you're retired?
Well, I want to do a lot of things that I wanted to do. Our whole family's always been musically inclined.
Play musical instruments?
Well, I'm the only one that did not have any music.
Oh, I see.
But I would like to. So I would like to. I'm ready to set up a piano lessons.
Oh,
My older sister played the piano, and my younger brother, of course, was a music teacher. I mean, that's what he was.
Uh-huh.
And so I would like to take piano lessons, which I will.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to start as soon as I get my trips out of the way.
Yeah.
And other things like bowling. I want to do bowling. I love cooking. If there are cooking classes around, I like to take those. cooking always fascinates me.
Do you do like Japanese style cooking?
Well, yes, I can cook Japanese. I used to cook a lot, even when I was an undergraduate. And I learned from my mother.
Oh,
and
uh-huh.
I've been learning from my sister, then whoever would teach me anything, whatever they would teach me, not only Japanese, but a very close friend of mine, that when we were graduate students, I lived with Dr. Consigli at K-State. We're students here together. Well, the name, you can just from his name, is Italian.
Mm-hmm.
So I learned a lot of Italian cooking from him, and which I still use, and Chinese cooking I learned. And so cookbooks are one of my big things that I love to look at and learn from anyone who is not baking, but
cooking.
So that's thing. Bowling, I'm going to get back to bowling. I'm going to go back to horseback riding, which I used to do a long time ago. And if I run out of things, are you in planning to go to bartender school? Not to do that as a living, but just I'm curious.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So you'll know how to mix your own
drinks, I mean,
for entertainment.
I was on the other side of the bar for all these years, and I want to see what it is to be on the other side. And I understand they have a bartender's academy in Kansas City.
Oh, I didn't know that.
So I eventually would like to just take that course, just for my own satisfaction.
Yeah.
But things like that.
Uh-huh.
But and travel in the meantime.
Yeah.
So.
What is your assessment of KU, especially your department, past, present, hopes for the future, that kind of thing?
Well, the department was very, very good. We had a very good reputation nationally, internationally, really.
Mm-hmm.
When I was involved in all the, you know, when in its heyday.
Yeah.
And then gradually the budget starts, problems began, and then when I was during my tenure as chair, it was fine. We were hiring people, with good people, good young people, and everything, and. I guess they were too good, the people we hired.
You mean they leave?
They left, yes, because other places wanted them too, and we couldn't compete because KU doesn't pay very well, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so we started to lose people, and gradually it was just a very slow thing. And are these things going to go out to people, this sort of thing?
Well, this will be it will be filed in the Alumni Center and the archives. You will see it before it's filed. You can make any changes, take anything out you want to, whatever.
But I mean, other people can listen to it?
I don't know what they do with the tapes, actually. Oh, if they want to read it, they can.
Oh, well, okay. The reason why I'm saying is that as our department started going down, because people were leaving, we're having a difficult time filling their positions,
mm-hmm.
getting permission to fill their permission. and the strategy of the dean's office at that time was this. When, in 1968, because of various departments, biological science departments getting kind of weak, no enrollment or very little enrollment, the one way that the biological sciences departments could survive was to go in as a division, biological science division, which they proposed. Okay, so they called a meeting of all the biological sciences and said, if we go under this umbrella of the division, then you will be protected. The regents cannot look at you, or no one can look at you and say, you're weak, we're going to get rid of you. But microbiology was very strong. We all had grants, we were publishing, so we said we don't want to go into the division. And the other biological science division, the department was radiation biophysics, that said they did not want to go in. So every other department went in.
And that was became systematics and ecology, is that what
well,
you're talking about?
That was one department, systematics and ecology.
Mm-hmm.
Physiology and cell biology. Physiology and cell biology was another department.
Oh,
entomology was another department, botany was another department, biochemistry was another department, and so on.
Uh-huh.
So all of them went into the division.
Oh, I see.
Microbiology was an island. Biophysics was an island, but eventually they got pushed into it. So they went in. So it was out microbiology and the division. And every dean that came up, even when I was a chair, they would say, how come you're not in the division? Well, we don't feel like we're weak. You know? I mean, we can stand up on our own. We don't need the division. We're very happy the way we are. And being very successful academically, research-wise, grant-wise, everything, our departmental budget was as big as the division's budget.
Oh. All right.
Now, that's not going to go unnoticed by the people in the division. They say, how come microbiology gets so much money and this and that? And they just kept going to the dean and everything until finally they slowly started to get this, where we were starting to slowly get into a position where we should have been. I shouldn't say should have been. Their budget was going up where it should have been, mm-hmm. because their budget was pretty low. But they always said, come into the division to us, people in the division. We said, we don't have to, we don't want to. And many people used to say, don't come in, it's not very good. Our friends used to tell us that. But anyway, from the dean's standpoint, it would be much easier to deal with one person, the head of all the division, rather than one person plus microbiology, mm-hmm. and another. And so they have always tried to get us involved, and they said they will never force us to go in unless we ask to go in. So the deans were very good about that. Well, now we're coming up to the 1989 and so on. I shouldn't say anyone, but the people in the dean's office, as people in our department moved, they said, well, we don't have enough money to give you to hire someone new. Well, but people in the division were getting money to rehire any vacancies. And so another person from our department would leave, and they say, well, we don't have any money. And so from a full staff of 10, we finally came down to 5. Half, and now we're getting pretty small. And not only that, our enrollment is going up more than when we had 10.
Oh my.
And we're doing all that with 5 people. And finally, the dean says, you got to come into the division. You have to come in, or else, you know, there are various consequences. And so we were more or less forced to go in, but we said, well, give us 3 years. Just phase in 3 years. First year, we'll see how the division, in other words, we'll go into the division, but let us still get our own budget.
Mm-hmm.
Not let the division handle our budget. They wanted our budget. They want our money. That's what they wanted. And so they said, okay, 3 years, we can handle our own budget, although we're in the division. And so this is the third year, as a matter of fact. So we got into the division now 2 years ago, and slowly are phasing in. And as soon as we joined the division, all of a sudden we got permission to hire a lot of people. It's a way that I personally don't feel that was right. The deans, they knew that we were strong, and now they deliberately wanted to make us weak so that we had to get into the division, or they can tell us to go into the division. And because of that, we're in the division now, and I don't know how they are now. I'm glad I'm not in the department right now, because I don't think the future of microbiology is going to be that good. And yet it is microbiology that's going to be one of the more important fields in the medical sciences.
I don't think so.
You think of all the genetic,
mm-hmm.
you know, all the thing on DNA, the O.J. Simpson, the DNA evidence, all that started from microbiology. Mm-hmm. That the whole science of that began with microbiology. This whole thing on the immune response, the HIV and all that, that's all microbiology. The viruses, you know, all microbiology, and the nutrition, where we got all our information on vitamins and all of these things, all started with microbiology, and now we're very well aware of the E. coli thing and the hamburgers.
Yeah.
Don't ever eat any hamburger that's pink. And
mm-hmm.
We tell our students that, and the salmonella problem, that you have to be careful in the poultry, and there's so many aspects of health that involve microbiology, so that it is microbiology that's still going to be one of the big important fields, and the biggest problem hasn't even come yet, and that's the use of antibiotics. The bacteria are becoming so resistant to antibiotics that pretty soon, from an ordinary scratch, it can turn into a septicemia. That is to say, the whole infectious process go through until there's nothing that you can do about it. No antibiotics will help. From a simple infection, you'll die. I mean, it can get to that point. Pre-war, we call it pre-antibiotic era, or I can say pre-World War II. I grew up in a period where there were no antibiotics. And I remember friends of mine who would just get an earache, and then 2 days later, they'd be dead.
Really?
No antibiotics.
Uh-huh.
They get a scratch, goes in and becomes, they call it blood poisoning at that time.
Yes.
And they would die from it. And there's nothing you can do about it, because we did not know what antibiotics were at that time. And I still remember those times. And we are entering that period again, because doctors are prescribing antibiotics for people who really don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
And people are asking for antibiotics when they don't need it, and doctors will give it to them because they don't want to lose that patient. And then these people are ruining this whole process.
So you mean that they'll have to discover new antibiotics or something?
Well, yes. It was 1979, the Surgeon General made the statement, we don't have to worry about infectious diseases anymore. Antibiotics will take care of everything. Let's concentrate on heart disease, let's concentrate on cancer, let's concentrate on this, but don't worry about infectious diseases, bacterial diseases.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it was one of the more stupid remarks to make, because from then on, 1991, only one new antibiotic was developed by pharmaceutical companies. In 1992, I'm one or two off, only three. 1993, back to one. 1994, about three. When there used to be 10, 20 new antibiotics every year. But now, in the past, from 91 to 94, not even 10 new antibiotics came out on the market, which shows that they're not doing any research in new antibiotics. I think they're starting now, but that we're a few years behind now, because they're realizing now that the bacteria that the ordinary common bacteria that causes pimples, that causes boils, now they are causing a massive infection and killing people.
Why?
And before, they used to just treat them with penicillin.
Mm-hmm.
They can't do it anymore. And some of them, you go in the hospital, 50% of every case of this staphylococcal infection is due to an organism that is resistant to every antibiotic except one. And they're trying to hide that antibiotic from this organism until they have to use it, until there's the last effort. If that organisms get resistant to that antibiotic, that one antibiotic, which it will, then there's nothing you can do about it. And there are people dying from a common infection right now. And these are some of the problems. And it's microbiology again. KU, one of the things about KU, everyone is trying to protect their own fields, which is good. I think this is human nature. And people in the dean's office, there are some biologists in there, they're trying to protect and help people in their particular field of interest, and not help microbiology as much when they should. And so microbiology at this time will make a comeback, I think. The younger people that we hired are very good. I really am impressed with the four younger people that we hired in the past 3 years. They're very good. I just hope that they won't be ruined by not microbiology, but by certain administrative decisions.
Yeah.
But if they're allowed to do as they want to do, I think these four plus maybe one more, my replacement, might help build the microbiology department back to the level where we were once a very well respected department.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just hoping that this will be the case.
Yeah. Well, I think that's about it. Is there anything I didn't ask you that I should have or that you want to add?
No, I think the 34 years that I spent at KU were a very happy one. I really enjoyed every year. I mean, it went so fast.
Yeah.
It went so quick that it's hard to believe, that I was here for 34 years.
Yeah.
And it has to do with when you're having fun, time goes by very quickly. And it was all fun, really. The teaching as well as the research.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but the community of Lawrence.
Yeah.
It's something that one rarely finds throughout the United States. I will have to admit that if the right place becomes available, I may go back to the Seattle area, back to my roots.
Uh-huh.
I have a lot of good friends there. From camp, I still have a lot of good friends.
Oh, you mean
many of them went back to the
West. They went back.
Most of them did.
Uh-huh.
So some of them I haven't seen in 40 years, 50 years, but we still keep in contact.
Oh, really?
Yes, and I would like to see them. It'll be a very difficult decision if I were to find a place back there.
Yeah.
It's sort of ambivalence there. Or maybe if my son decides, my son loves Lawrence, my older son. He keeps coming back here, and maybe I may make a deal with him, saying, "You want this house? You can buy this house. Let me go out to Seattle.
And then
I can
you
come
have
back.
A place to
right,
visit.
And
yes.
I can come back and forth.
Uh-huh.
Right.
That'd be nice.
So, but Lawrence has been a very nice place. If at all possible, I'd like to stay here.
Yeah. Well, okay.